Let's turn to the Belgic Confession, Article 37. This time we'll read the first and third paragraphs. Belgic Confession, Article 37, paragraphs 1 and 3. Finally, after all the preceding 36 articles, finally, we believe, according to the Word of God, when the time appointed by the Lord, which is unknown to all creatures, is come, and the number of the elect complete, that our Lord Jesus Christ will come from heaven, corporally and visibly, as he ascended with great glory and majesty to declare himself judge of the quick and the dead, burning this old world with fire and flame to cleanse it. Paragraph 3. And therefore, the consideration of this judgment is justly terrible and dreadful to the wicked and ungodly, but most desirable and comfortable to the righteous and the elect, because then their full deliverance shall be perfected, and there they shall receive the fruits of their labor and trouble which they have borne. Their innocence shall be known to all, and they shall see the terrible vengeance which God shall execute on the wicked, who most cruelly persecuted, oppressed, and tormented them in this world, and who shall be convicted by the testimony of their own consciences, and being immortal shall be tormented in that everlasting fire which is prepared for the devil and his angels. Beloved, we have been and we are considering the teaching of the writing prophets, major and minor, the last 16 or 17 books of the Old Testament, the teaching of the major and minor or writing prophets on the last or latter days in chronological order. I should grab one of these handouts. We've been treating them in chronological order. We began with three contemporaries, namely Isaiah, Micah, and Hosea, in that order. Two of them were prophets in the southern kingdom, Isaiah and Micah, and we're referring here to their prophecies in Isaiah 2 and Micah 4 on the last days, which prophecies are practically the same thing. And then one of them is a prophet of the northern kingdom, namely Hosea, chapter 3. Now we have moved forward in time to two later contemporaries, namely Jeremiah, and today's subject, and next week, Ezekiel. Not only were these two men both prophets, as you would expect in the listing we're giving, but they were also both priests. Prophets and priests. Isaiah wasn't a priest. Daniel wasn't a priest, to take the other two major prophets, but Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And in your Old Testament, you have Jeremiah, Lamentations. Jeremiah wrote both. And then Ezekiel. Those two were both priests. There were some differences between Jeremiah and Ezekiel, prophets and priests. They differed as to their location. For Jeremiah, his location was Jerusalem in the southern kingdom. Like Isaiah and Micah before him. And Ezekiel was located in Babylon, in the captivity. With regard to time, Jeremiah began his ministry some years before Ezekiel, because he was called in the 13th of the 31 years of the reign of King Josiah, the last good king of Jerusalem and Judah. These two men, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, also differ as to the number of references in their books to the last days. For Jeremiah, there are how many references? It's just last week. Four. You're all just too shy. And Ezekiel has how many references? One. Just one. That's our subject this week. There is enough material, though we covered Jeremiah's four references in 1 week, there is enough material for tonight's class with just one text from Ezekiel, and enough actually for two classes, and that's what we're going to have on this great prophet. We're going to begin where we always begin, after the introduction, of course, with the text itself. Read with me, either in your Bibles or on the handout, with 14 Old Testament texts on the last or latter days, Ezekiel 38, verse 16. "And thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days. And I will bring thee against my land, that the heathen may know me, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes." Now, everyone agrees, at least everyone that I've looked at, and it's hard to see how anyone would disagree, that Ezekiel 38 and 39 constitute a unit. Ezekiel 38 and 39. And they, of course, a two-chapter unit, precede Ezekiel 40 through 48, the last nine chapters, which deal with a glorious temple and a new priesthood and sacrifices and rituals like the Mosaic, but different. It's a definite, unique block, 40 to 48. And just immediately before it, we have chapters 38 and 39. They're a unit. They deal, these two chapters, with the attack of Gog, the head or leader, over many countries upon Israel, the people of God. We could summarize the content of these three chapters in terms of three words. First of all, we have invasion. Gog and his forces invade the land of Israel, and it especially mentions the mountains of Israel. That's that mountainous chain which runs north and north-south between the Mediterranean coastline and the Sea of Galilee, River Jordan, and Dead Sea. So it runs right north-south up the middle of the country, a bit like the Pennines for parts of England. Invasion, that's number one. Then destruction, because God destroys the invading forces. And then disposal. The enemy forces invade the land of Israel. They are destroyed. And then we have the disposal of their weaponry and of the dead bodies. And just to give a hint where we're going in this class and next week, this invasion is the most impressive invasion mentioned anywhere in the Old Testament, in terms of the numbers, for instance, and the diversity of the invaders. The destruction is the most impressive destruction of any force that invaded the land of Israel mentioned in the Old Testament, because they are destroyed in, depending on how you divide it up, they're destroyed in about a dozen different ways. And then, and this one's perhaps even the most distinctive of these three, we read here in Ezekiel 38 and 39 more of the disposal of the weaponry and the dead bodies of the invaders who have just been destroyed more than anywhere else in the Old Testament. What I'm getting at, more in this week and next week, is that if someone had read, let's say, from Genesis 1 all the way up to Ezekiel 37, and then he came to chapters 38 and 39, he would have said, "Whoa, now this is something else. This is at a higher order than any other invasion. This is a more terrible destruction than any other battle, and the Old Testament history and the Old Testament prophets record many invasions and much destruction. And then the disposal. This is some disposal job. In fact, you hardly ever see anything about disposal after battles, but this book goes into it in a big way. The weapons that are disposed of, see if anyone can remember that part in Ezekiel 39, the weapons become fuel for the fire, and they feed the fires for how long? 7 years. 7 years fuel from the weapons of the invading army. And then the bodies of the dead, the carcasses, how long did it take to bury all these dead soldiers? I'll give you a clue. It's another 7 months. 7 months. Now, at this point, we could just quote our text, Ezekiel 18, verse 16. Thou, Gog, who's addressed throughout chapter 38, thou, Gog, shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land, invasion. It shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the heathen may know me, that is, when I destroy you, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes. So we could just quote our text and say that our text, Ezekiel 38, verse 16, tells us that the unit, Ezekiel 38 and 39, all happen in the last days. That is the period between the first coming of Christ, his incarnation, his cross and burial, resurrection, his outpouring of the Holy Spirit, all the way to his second coming. We could say Ezekiel 38 verse 16 tells us that all this is going to happen in the last days. We are in the last days. It hasn't happened yet within the period of the last days, but it will happen sometime between now and the second coming of Jesus Christ. And we could say, what's the time? We've been going now for maybe 25 minutes. End of class. We could say that. I mean, theoretically, we could say that. And George, that'd be a very bad way to operate, because you would feel shortchanged that you haven't been able to come for all these months. And the minister wound the whole thing up after 20 minutes. But this would not be very satisfactory, not only for George, but for all of us. Because you would be wondering, okay, so it's somewhere in the last days. Ezekiel 38 to 39 hasn't happened yet. But can we say when, within the period of the last days? Is there more to be said on the when question? Then you would say, this is a class on eschatology. You'd say to the minister, me, you need to work with this passage and fit it into eschatology. And now you're selling us short on Ezekiel 38 verse 16 in the context. You're going to treat this very differently than you did the 9 New Testament texts on the other side of the handout and the 7 Old Testament prophets that we've looked at yet. And then you'd say, to sharpen the prick to goad me and beat me over the head with, you're going to make it a big heavy hammer. You're reneging on this most fascinating chapter and chapters in Ezekiel. I want to know what Ezekiel 38 and 39 says. And you might also be saying, since this is a class on the last days that deals with Gog and Magog, and Ezekiel 38 and 39, you might also be saying, you've got to say more about this in a class on the end times, because this passage is referred to in the New Testament. Namely,
Revelation.
Well, I'm at 16, 16,
and
28. Oh, okay. The two, Julian quoted Revelation 16, verse 16, a reference to Armageddon, gathering them together into a place called in the Hebrew Armageddon, and then Revelation 20, verse 8. Yes, Revelation 20 is the chapter I was thinking of explicitly, because it says that the devil or Satan shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. So you've got Ezekiel 38 and 39, fascinating in itself. Then we've got Revelation 20, which quotes this passage. And this chapter, Revelation 20, deals with the millennium, or the thousand years, another big factor in eschatology. So we're all agreed then that we are going to go deeper. Now I'll give you in part my difficulty in terms of presenting this material. My difficulty was, here we have two chapters. There are 23 verses, and in my Bible that's a page and a half, and 29 verses, which is almost two pages. And so in terms of teaching this, I thought to myself, we're going to have to work our way through these two chapters so that everybody here, including the youngest Jason, has some idea of the contents. So what we're going to have to do, turn with me to the start of Ezekiel 38. Start of Ezekiel 38. And we're going to go through this chapter in five main blocks of materials, and the next chapter in six blocks of materials, to summarize the message. Because we need to know, first of all, not just the answer. What do we do with this? How do we sort this out? But we actually need to know, first of all, the question. What is the passage saying, that we work with it and see how it fits into biblical and reformed eschatology? The first unit, then, is Ezekiel 38, verses 1 through 6. Here Ezekiel, in verse 2, called the Son of Man, is commanded by God to set his face against Gog, because God's face is against Gog. Verse 3. Gog, as I mentioned earlier, is addressed throughout Ezekiel 38 and is also the subject in much of chapter 39. Gog is an individual. We'll say more about him. Gog was in the land of Magog, and there are the first two proper nouns in Ezekiel 38, 39 that occur in the second verse, and this is where Revelation 20 gets the names Gog and Magog from. Gog, this ruler, an individual, a person, is of the land of Magog, and then the translation of verse 2 differs. The word rendered chief can mean first or chief or principal, or it can be referring to a place. And so it could be Gog, who's of the land of Magog, and who is, as to his office, the prince of Rosh, the Hebrew rendered chief, here taking it as a place, and Meshech and Tubal. Prophesy against him. Prophesy, Ezekiel, against this prince or mighty ruler. And then God says regarding Gog that God will put hooks in his jaws and bring him forth to fight. We're going to see later that he's going to fight against Israel. But, of course, Gog wanted to do this battle, and he, we're told, is motivated to fight, according to verse 10 and 11, which tells us exactly what his motivation was. But God is irresistibly and providentially going to put a hook in his jaw, as it were, like the catching of a fish. And Ezekiel uses this imagery with regard to Pharaoh in Egypt, in that large unit, in the late 20s and early 30s, 29 through 32 of Ezekiel. So I'm going to put hooks, plural, into your jaws and bring you forth with all your army and horses and horsemen. So there's the infantry and the cavalry, all of them clothed with armor, large shields and small shields. The army is further described as embracing people of, verses 5 and 6, Persia, Ethiopia, Libya, Gomer, and Togarma. And they have shields and helmets. And they are going to attack, verse 6 says, from the north quarters, and many people will be with thee. So you could say, here's the mustering of the army. You're going to preach, and declare a word of judgment, Ezekiel, against Gog the ruler and all of these nations who are fighting with them and other peoples. Verses 7 through 9, the next unit, God tells Gog, the leader of this mighty force, to get ready for the battle. Verse 7, be thou, Gog, prepared, and prepare for yourself, you and your company that's gathered together, because after many days, and think now, Ezekiel is delivering this prophecy and God is speaking to him, in the days of the Babylonian captivity, you're going to be brought into the land. Here it's the land of Israel, the land that is brought back from the sword. You're going to come against the mountains of Israel. Think now that mountain range running north and south, as I said, between the beaches of the Mediterranean and the water of the Sea of Galilee, the River Jordan, and the Dead Sea. And you are going to come with all your forces like a storm against the people of Israel. You, like a cloud, will cover the land. Then verses 10 through 13 describe, amongst other things, the personal motivations of God. Sorry, Mary?
Is latter years in verse 8 the same basically as latter days?
Mary's asking, is the phrase latter years in verse 8 the same as the latter days in verse 16, our key text? And the answer is no, but it's a very good question. Latter years mean years in the future, and latter days is a technical term which we've defined elsewhere. Verses 10 through 13. Here, having said that God was going to put a hook, or hooks even in his jaw, so that he came into battle against Israel, we're told the subjective thinking of Gog. Verse 10, it shall also come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought. The thinking of Gog, we're told here. Something's going to occur to you, an idea. And the idea is basically twofold. The people of Israel are an easy prey, verse 11. Unwalled villages, no fortifications. They are at rest and dwelling safely, with no walls, no bars, no gates. So easy prey, verse 11. And verse 12 says, on the other hand, that they are wealthy. They want to take a spoil or prey, verse 12, or plunder. And then verse 12 mentions livestock and goods. Livestock and goods. And at the end of verse 13, silver and gold. So here you've got, if you were an invading army, you have what you most want, easy pickings, very little in the way of defense, and number two, rich pickings. So it's easy way to get wealth. Then verse 13, commentators differ here. Verse 13 mentions three countries or places, Sheba in the Arabian Peninsula, and Dedan in that area too, and Tarshish, which is harder to nail down. Some people say it's Spain or Portugal at the far end of the Mediterranean. Others say it's a city in eastern Africa. And one guy I was reading today, he said other people reckon it could be Great Britain. That was a new one on me. I don't know where he got that from. In terms of Tarshish and its use in the Old Testament, Tarshish could also be just the Hebrew way of saying somewhere ways off. Because sometimes Tarshish seems to be a place that you can get to by the sea if you go west across the Mediterranean. Like Jonah got in a ship heading to Tarshish. And other times it looks as if, like with Solomon's navy, that they're going south into the Red Sea. And then somewhere like the east coast of Africa would make sense. But anyway, it doesn't matter too much for our present purposes. Sheba and Dedan and Tarshish, and then it mentions the merchants of Tarshish, they're, as it were, looking on and seeing this mighty army going to attack Israel, rich pickings, but also easy pickings. And then the commentators differ. Some say that these three places resist the enemies. I don't see that personally, but that they're opposed to it. And this especially within the pre-mill school. That these are ones who are sympathetic to Israel. And others say, and this is what it seems like to me, Sam, you're not, I can see you're not in favor of that one. Other ones say that that Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish think to themselves, there could be some money in this for us. And I can see Sam's nodding at that one. Sheba, Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof, that would fit with the idea of traders who want to enrich themselves with this booty. They will say, are you come to take a spoil? Are you gathered to take a prey? To take away silver, gold, cattle and goods? A great spoil? That is, we'd like to buy some of that from you and trade with you. Which, I must admit, Sam, I'm in agreement with you there. Then the next unit is 14 through 16. If the previous unit, 10 through 13, has been looking at the attack from the perspective of Gog, his motivation to attack, 10 through 12, and then Sheba, Dedan, and Tarshish, who see, hey, there could be something in this for us. Well, then verse 14 tells us what God is doing. He's sovereign over all of this. Verse 14, here's my people Israel dwelling safely. You know fine well that they're haven't much in the way of defense. And now you're coming out of the northern parts with all your horsemen, a vast army. Verse 15. And you're coming up as a cloud. I know that you're going to do this, God says. I know when you're going to do this. In the latter days. And then the absolute sovereignty of God is underscored by the word I, especially by the word I in the middle of verse 16. I will bring thee against my land. Another way of referring to the hooks that God would put in Gog's mouth to make sure that he came in. I will bring thee against my land. And my goal here, very different from your goal, you want easy and rich pickings. My goal is that the heathen will know me because I will be sanctified in thee before their eyes. In that, to run ahead of ourselves, I am going to destroy you. You have one plan. And I have a different purpose in it all. Then verse 17, which is certainly one of the most intriguing verses, and we'll deal with it in some detail next week, Lord willing. I want to just read this. God says, to Gog, art thou he of whom I have spoken in old time by my servants, the prophets of Israel? Which prophesied those days many years, that I would bring thee against them. Not going to say any more now, but this verse, beyond this verse is saying that God had prophesied through earlier Old Testament prophets in Israel that a man like Gog with a huge army would attack the people of God. And after making that powerful and intriguing thought, verses 18 to the end of the chapter speak about the destruction of Gog. When Gog, verse 18 says, will come against the land of Israel, my fury shall come up in my face. That is, God will be like a man who is so angry that his face is red and steam might be coming out of his ears or nostrils, Jason. He's really, really angry. And this is a very vivid portion. And it's another way in which this passage says to us, this is something different from the usual treatment of the destruction of the wicked in the Old Testament. Verse 19 carries that imagery further. In my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath have I spoken. And now verse 19 says, first of all, the judgment is going to take the form of an earthquake. Earthquake. That's the idea of the phrase, a great shaking. There shall be a great shaking in the land of Israel. And this is some earthquake. This great earthquake will shake the fish of the sea. Now maybe some of you know more about, I imagine you do, know more about earthquakes than I do. An earthquake shaking the fish of the sea.
Tsunami,
okay, because it's gonna create. In a tsunami, do the fish shake? I really don't know.
Until they hit the shore, it's just like a swelling, isn't it?
Like a swelling, yes. Yes. So it must be some quake to make them shake in some form, or it could be hyperbole. So here's this earthquake. It affects, number one, the fish of the sea. Number two, the fowls of the heaven. Now, if we struggle to see what way an earthquake, or even an earthquake that causes a tsunami, could affect the fish of the sea, a bird in the air is hardly going to be affected by an earthquake. I mean, if he's on a branch and the branch shakes, you know, but anyway, the fish of the sea are affected. So think down, and then water collects usually under the earth. The sea is lower than the land. And then the fowls of the heaven above. And then number three, the beasts of the field. And number four, all creeping things that creep upon the earth. And again, we're back to this issue. It would be some earthquake that would kind of shake up the cockroaches. You don't really envision them being too troubled by an earthquake. And my point, is it in any way to belittle or criticize the scripture text? My point is, and some of you already are feeling this, because you know the right interpretation of Scripture, and some of you will know the way I explain these prophecies, the minister's particular style, that we're not moving in the field of literalism here. We're getting to something more than just an ordinary earthquake. So, the earthquake affects the fish of the sea, the fowls of the heaven, the beasts of the field, the creeping things that creep upon the earth, and then number five, all the men that are upon the face of the earth. All the men that are upon the face of the earth. But I thought this was just a certain number of countries attacking Israel. Sometimes earth can mean land of Israel. In other places it means the whole world. So there we have an earthquake that affects five different types of creature. Birds, beasts, fish, creeping things, and men. That's a pretty big classification in Old Testament language of different types of living things. Five of them. And then we're told of the effects of this great earthquake upon the land. The mountains shall be thrown down. The mountains in the land of Israel, or all mountains? Mountains, number two. Number two, the steep places shall fall. Because you can have something that's steep, but not a mountain. That is, it's steep, but it doesn't go way up. A mountain requires a certain amount of height. And then three, every wall shall fall to the ground. So there you would have city walls, though there aren't any in Israel, according to the picture here. You would have every wall in a house, all four falling down. The wall, let's say, that you've built at the end of your garden, every wall will come down. Every wall? Now, they didn't have the same building codes that they have in developed countries, never mind the building codes that they have in a place which is affected with earthquakes like Japan. There you've got a developed world on a fault line, and so they have a lot of building codes to make sure that buildings can withstand earthquakes. But here we have an earthquake that affects living creatures in five different types of living creatures. Mountains fall down, steep places fall down, and every wall falls to the ground. It gets harder and harder to take it literally. Hillary.
It also happened with the Twin Towers in 9/11. So you can imagine things like skyscrapers all coming down.
Yes. So Hillary's point is, think of what happened on September 11 in terms of the... What was that? 2001. 2001. And then think of that happening, as it were, every city in New York, and every city in America, and every city, to go back to this vision, every city in Israel, and every structure, and maybe the world. To continue, we have this earthquake Then verse 21 talks about infighting. So we have the earthquake, and that's explained. It depends how you divide it. You could say the earthquake affects five types of living creature and three non-living things: mountains, steep slopes, and walls. And then we have infighting. So this invading army, the earthquake's going to get it. And if an earthquake can make every wall fall down, every mountain fall down, and every steep place fall down, you wonder why you need infighting. But anyway, infighting. Verse 21, I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith the Lord. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. So they fall out, these people who are going to attack Israel. And they kill each other. Infighting. Now this happens in various places in the Old Testament. In Old Testament histories, can you think of any?
Gideon.
Gideon's 300 come and they blow the trumpets and the light comes at night and it scares the Midianites with the men in the east and so forth, and then they kill each other. It happens also in 2 Chronicles 20 and other places. So that's verse 21. Then verse 22, I will plead against him with pestilence. Another word for pestilence. Plague or disease. With blood, that is bloodshed, and that would probably, that makes you think of warfare, but I suppose there are various ways to shed blood. And then comes a rain. I will rain upon him, that is Gog, and upon his bands or soldiery, and upon all the people that are with him, an overflowing rain, great hailstones, fire, and brimstone. So we have here an earthquake, and then we've subdivided that. Then we have infighting. Then we have pestilence or disease. And then, of course, pestilence or disease is actually quite a common thing in armies. It breaks out among the camp and so forth. Often in older days, it happened a lot, for instance, in the Revolutionary War, and then dysentery and so forth, and slaughtered many of the troops. So pestilence and then blood, or bloodshed, and then this rain. And the rain includes water, hailstones, great hailstones. The book of Revelation speaks about great hailstones too. Fire being rained down, and brimstone. And the raining down of brimstone makes you think of Sodom and Gomorrah. The raining down of brimstone. That's some rain. And then you wonder, you know, rain is coming down, water, and fire. Brimstone is coming down, and hailstones. So you have an awful lot of heat with the fire and brimstone, yet you also have it coming down in the form of rain, and not just rain, but hailstones, frozen. So it's colder than 0 degrees Celsius or centigrade. And then if you take this, there's an earthquake, which is going to quake five different types of living creatures. Mountains are going to come down, steep places, and all walls. Then they're going to fight against amongst each other, and you wonder how much did the earthquake kill. They're going to fight amongst each other. Then pestilence, I mean, it's going to have to break out like that and just run through them. And people who are suffering from sickness aren't the sort of people who, with their remaining strength, start hacking the limbs off their neighbor. And then it's going to rain water and hail, ordinary sort of meteorological events, and then also fire and brimstone at the same time. And all of these things seemingly happening at the same time. Earthquakes and pestilence and fire and brimstone and infighting. These, in short, are the various ways, many, if not most of the various ways in the Old Testament, both in history and in prophecy, that destroy an army. And you have actually here most of them all happening at once. And I come back to the main point, and that's why I'm drawing this out. This is an unusual prophecy. This is an unusual passage. We're not dealing here with literalistic prophecy or an ordinary sort of battle. We're dealing with something eschatological, miraculous, wondrous. That's chapter 38. Oh, one more thing. Verse 23. Thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself, that is, in sovereignly ordering this invasion with its, and their destruction, and particularly the instruction, the destruction, "I'll magnify and sanctify myself, and everyone will know that I am the Lord." Everybody more or less happy with that cursory, although it ended up being less cursory than I had planned, cursory treatment of chapter 38. Do you feel you've got a grip of that chapter? Because it's not the easiest chapter to understand. Right, let's move to chapter 39. Chapter 39 is a repetition of some of the things in chapter 8 and an enlargement and development of some of the things in chapter 38. It's a bit like the relationship between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. Genesis 1 gives us the first 6 days of creation. And then Genesis 2 isn't, as the old liberal critics who couldn't read the Bible, it's just hopeless. And they say this is another account. These are two contradictory accounts of creation. And you think, you know, you guys are getting paid a fortune in a university to sit and write books, and you have an easy, cushy life, and you really don't have a clue what the Bible's saying. You are so blind. Chapter 2 of Genesis develops and enlarges upon and builds upon chapter 1 and brings out different aspects of it. And this is a common Hebrew way of working. It's not just Genesis 1 and 2. Here it is in Ezekiel 38 and 39, and there are many other passages. Ezekiel 38 gives you the main picture. Ezekiel 39 moves forward in time a bit and then jumps back and elaborates and develops other things in chapter 38. Let's continue. Ezekiel 39, 1 through 7, develops the idea of the destruction and begins with the word in verse 1, "Behold, I am against thee, O Gog." And again, the repetition here, God is against Gog. This Gog must be pretty awful for God Almighty to keep saying he is against him. That makes him a special form of evil person. More on that next week. The word sixth in the middle of verse 2 is, I need to do more research on this, but it is, I think at this stage, probably not the right translation. And I'm saying that not just to fit the theory, but this is what the scholars say. Verse 2, "I will turn thee back and leave but the sixth part of thee." Now, there are various groups that could use the sixth part to help them. But even they agree that really it's just, maybe you have it in your margin, "I will turn thee back and lead you on and will cause thee to come from the north parts." Sometimes with Hebrew it's hard to know how to translate certain words. So this prophecy, God says, "I'm going to bring you up, I'm going to bring you to the mountains, and I'm going to knock the bow and arrows out of your hands," verse 3. "You're going to fall upon the mountains," verse 4, "and the peoples with you, and ravenous birds and beasts will eat your dead bodies." You'll fall in the open field. And then verse 6 makes an intriguing point. "I will send a fire on Magog." And then the question is, we don't have to resolve it now, but just be aware of the issue. Does this mean the forces of Magog or Magog the place? "I will send a fire on Magog." So think of these armies that invaded Israel according to the picture here. And God is going to destroy them with fire amongst other things. And then verse 6 would be saying, "And I'm also going to send a fire on Magog itself," the sending country of these soldiers, "and among them that dwell carelessly in the isles." And that supports the idea that it's the land, not even in Israel, God will send. And when it says those that dwell carelessly in the isles, that means, especially now think of the book of Isaiah, Gentile territory, the coastlands, the way off, the far off regions. "And they too will know that I am the Lord." This is an unusual prophecy. And then God says, and this we're going to look at more next week, the theodicy, the glorification of God in so doing, that is in defeating the armies, verses 1 through 5 of chapter 39, in sending fire on Magog and the isles and coastlands afar off, "everyone will know my holy name." It's getting cosmic and global. The next unit verses 8 through 10 says that after God has destroyed the army, the invading army, and Magog and the isles with fire, it will take 7 years to burn the weapons of the dead soldiers. 7 years. Nothing like that anywhere else in the Old Testament. And then you might say, well, if verses 8 through 10 deal with the weapons, what about the dead bodies? Well, verses 11 through 16 say that it'll take 7 months with all the people of the land and people specially marked out to locate the dead bodies to bury them all. 7 months. If we say that 7 months is 30 days, and I'm doing this more for mathematical reasons than anything else, then you've got 210 days. So that's 7/12 of a year to bury the soldiering. Then verses 21 through 24 tell us that God will be glorified in the destruction of the various parties. But, whoops, I made a mistake. I skipped verses 6, 17 through 20. 17 through 20 tell us that the birds and the beasts will eat the dead bodies. We had a reference to that earlier in chapter 39, verse 4. Now, you may be sensing an issue. I'm going to deal with that later in this class. 17 through 20, the birds and beasts are going to eat the dead body of the invading bodies of the invading forces. 21 through 24, as I said, God will be glorified. And 25 through 29 make some applications of this to Israel's history of captivity in the Old Testament and who's responsible for their sins and ways. I went a bit more quickly with the second chapter so as not to weary you with too many details, but are you still with me? Mary, still with me. Okay. Now, Tibor.
This question of other parts will have these verses command be read. The lion will be eaten meat and something like that, and here we read that these animals are going to eat meat. So it's also shows that this picture and not going to be a literal agent that these animals are going to eat only vegetables or something like that.
Tibor, I understand you to be referring to Isaiah 11 and Isaiah 65, which speak of a time when lions and carnivores will no longer eat flesh.
And here we are reading that in the last days there's still going to be.
Ah, I get your point now. Very good point. As I understand what Tibor is saying, I'll elaborate a little bit. Some people say that the references to carnivores no longer eating flesh but becoming herbivores happens in the last days, or the period between the first and second coming of Christ, that in a post-millennial world, that not only will all the world become Christianized, the governments and the vast majority of people, but the deserts will begin to shrink, and this is actually quite important too in terms of human population. We're going to need the deserts to shrink, you know, to be able to find room for all the people, especially if the world's going to last for hundreds and thousands of years, as some pre-millennialists say, and then women are going to become more fertile and families are going to become larger. But in the post-millennial vision of some, towards the end of the last days and in the post-millennial golden age, the carnivores will no longer eat. And Tibor's point is, here's a passage, Ezekiel 38, 39, and if you're going to take it literal regarding the animals, as a post-mill would have to, take Isaiah 11 and Isaiah 65 with regard to the animals, and then they have to put it in the last days, then you have animals that are eating dead human beings. Ergo, we've caught you. Isn't that where you're going, Tibor? Very good point. I'm glad you mentioned that. Now, let's come to the meaning of Ezekiel 38 and 39. There are two intimately interwoven questions, one word questions: what and when. What is the passage about, and when is this going to happen? And your answer to the what question largely determines your answer to the when question, and if you answer the when question, that will lead you to a certain answer of the what question, more or less. That is, if you answer the what question in a literalistic fashion, that there is going to be a literal army, and then it literally is going to have to rain four or five different things at the same time as the pestilence is raging among the army, at the same time as that army is killing itself, and at the same time as the earthquake is shaking five different types of living creatures, and every mountain and slopey place and wall has fallen down. If you take the whole thing literalistically, well, then that'll point you to a certain view of eschatology, of course, and when. If you don't take it literalistically, and we don't take it literalistically, then when is going to be answered differently. Now, rightly or wrongly, most commentators and theologians, especially commentators and theologians who are fascinated with the eschatological standpoint, but most commentators and theologians especially approach Ezekiel 38 and 39 from the when perspective. When are these things going to come to pass? The postmillennialists are not so interested in Ezekiel 38 and 39. So the foil for the remainder of this class and next week, Lord willing, is going to be premillennialists, of the premillennial historic sort and the premillennial dispensational sort. So all sorts and stripes of premillennialists. The premillennialists, in their focus, deal with the when question very, very prominently. Some premillennialists believe that Ezekiel 38 and 39 happens before the tribulation. So some say that this refers to a pre-trib event. And now we have to step back and remind ourselves of the pre-mill schools. According to premillennialism, the next thing to happen, well, especially I'll talk about dispensationalist premillennialism. The next big event is the rapture, right? After the rapture, we have a 7-year tribulation. After the 7-year rapture, the 7-year tribulation, we have the millennium, a literal 1,000 years. Okay, so some of these dispensations say that Ezekiel 38 and 39 is pre-trib, before the tribulation, before the 7 years. Now, if you go that way, then it has to be before the rapture. Because the rapture is what introduces the tribulation. So it's before the rapture. But then they also say that the rapture has no signs before it. We could be raptured at any moment. But surely a massive, I mean, today's 24/7 news coverage, when most people, apart from the people like myself who are too miserable to get themselves a smartphone, or who can't be bothered learning all the difficult stuff, or who like the idea of finding some moments of the day where, I mean, you know, where you're uncontactable. How could that not be a sign then? This massive invasion of Israel and God raining down all these things, sending a pestilence and the people fighting among themselves in this massive earthquake. The rapture cannot be without signs. If this view is right, if Ezekiel 38 and 39 happens before the tribulation. Other people say, of the dispensational school, that Ezekiel 38 and 39 is mid-trib. It comes at the 3.5-year stage within the 7-year tribulation. And then you wonder, but if you're going to take this literally, it talks about 7 years. 7 years of fuel. And if the thing starts in the mid-trib and there's 7 years of fuel, then they're going to be burning the weaponry of the army of Gog for the first 3.5 years of the millennium. And then other people, can you guess what others think? Put yourself for a moment, but not for too long, in the pre-millennial dispensationalist shoes. Anybody guess? Post-trib. Some believe this is post-trib. And this is part of the reason why I've been saying they often approach this from a when perspective, post-trib. So at the very end of the seven-year tribulation, we're going to have Ezekiel 38 and 39. And then you're going to have 7 years of firewood in the millennium. And then I'm going to go with number five, because number four may be an eye-opener for some of you. Number five, although that's five there, it's not a six. Can you think of any other periods of time where the dispensationalists may want to put this?
End of millennium.
End of millennium. End of millennium. The fourth one, this is interesting. The fourth one is that some put Ezekiel 38 and 39 in the interlude. Anyone any idea what the interlude is?
The silence in heaven.
A decent guess, Julian. Julian said the silence in heaven mentioned in Revelation.
The parenthesis? Is that the same?
So Sam's saying, do they use the word interlude for the parenthesis, the church age? They don't, but that was a good guess too. The interlude is actually the interlude between the literal seven-year tribulation and the literal thousand-year millennium. There are some dispensationalists that have an interlude, and it's a certain number of days for them, and then some of them have a longer interlude than others. Did you ever hear this one, George? You've argued with some dispensationalists over the years, but so now you have after the rapture, we were thinking that, you know, it was a 7 year tribulation for their view and the 1,000 year millennium. That is two more periods before we get to the eternal state. But there's after the rapture, the 7 year tribulation and the interlude. And they see the interlude as being taught in Daniel chapter 12, the last chapter of Daniel, and some would argue for it from their interpretation of Ezekiel 38 and 39. So there's the 7 year tribulation, the interlude, which some have, some don't have, and some have it one length and some have it another length, and then there's the 1,000 year tribulation. And you think to yourself, no, the Bible teaches that Christ is coming again, and then we have the new heavens and new earth. Even so, come Lord Jesus. With the premillennial dispensationalists, they approach this especially in view of time, the when question even more so than the what. And then they come up with these five different when questions within their own school. And then I was thinking, and I thought, that's really strange, because Ezekiel 38 verse 16, God does actually give us the when answer. It says, it shall be in the latter days. And then I read the stuff, I said, they're not even working with us. The passage itself says it's in the latter days. And they're coming up with all these theories as to why it could be this or that or the other one or the other one or the other one. And you see, no, it's staring you in the face. It's in the middle of the first chapter. It says it's in the latter days. Work with that. Now, we don't actually agree with them always in the latter days, but you'd have thought that they said to themselves, because they do have a view of the latter days, and it varies probably from thinker to thinker, theologian to theologian, but you'd have thought that it worked with that. But no, they just set that aside. They just set that aside and then come up with these speculations as to when. And the passage itself tells you. Like, we could have at least have understood if they'd have said, well, the passage says the latter days, but they got the latter days wrong. But they didn't even work with the latter days phrase. And instead, they come up with this stuff. The Bible's own time frame of latter days is found in the passage. But it, at least the people I read, just ignored. And instead we ended up with some people bringing in the interlude of all things. Tibor.
Just a clarification that what the prominent believer about the latter days, which period is this, the millennium or the tribulation, or what they say, what's the latter days?
I understand Tibor to be asking, what do premillennial dispensationalists say the latter days means? Well, some believe there's a latter days for the Jews. And then some believe there's the latter days for the Gentiles. And yes, and then they differ among them. So they don't see the... Well, maybe there are some who believe the latter days is all the same period, and maybe there's some who just to ignore it. And I can't give you more specific ones. I haven't been reading just enough in that literature. I must admit, I suppose I'm like everybody who reads any subject, or most people. I'll use a Northern Ireland saying, it sort of does your head in after a while reading that stuff. You think to yourself, oh dear. Anyway, let's move on. For us, you know, we're looking at this passage, Ezekiel 38 and 39, and for us we're saying Ezekiel 38 verse 16 says it's in the latter days. The passage itself tells you. The latter days is the period between the first coming of Christ and his one second coming in the clouds of great glory to raise the dead, to judge the nations, and to bring in the new heavens and new earth. And we have looked at seven Old Testament texts, and they have all fitted in well with that framework. All fitted in well. Some have even required it. So we say, look, it says the last days. Then the next question, somebody would say, okay, for us, and this is the biblical view, where in the last days? At what point in the last days? Can we say, is this a helpful or an unhelpful question? We'll say more about that, Lord willing, next week. But at least we will say this, with regard to common ground with the premillennial dispensationists, it's always good to find common ground. We at least agree there is common ground between premillennials and premillennial dispensationalists and amillennials at this point with regard to Ezekiel 38 and 39, is that we actually do believe it's future, that it hasn't happened yet. But with regard to when in the future, well, we don't agree. Let's move then from the when question, when is this going to happen, to the what question. And here, and this is my closing section, pretty much, I want to explain why literalism, I've hinted at it, but why literalism doesn't work in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Doesn't work in general, but it doesn't work here. First of all, there are anachronisms in the text. I'll give you an example of an anachronism. Let's say someone here wanted to write historical fiction, and the leading figure in your first work of historical fiction, let's call him Samuel. He's in the 13th century, and he escapes from his enemies by hopping on his motorbike and riding off. Anachronism. They didn't have motorbikes in the 13th century, right? Anachronism. Sometimes with a word like anachronism, it's almost easier to give an example than define it. Here we have, look at the nations that are fighting against God's people. Verse 2, we have Magog, Rosh, possibly depending on how you translate the word chief, Meshach and Tubal. Where are these nations? Verse 5, Persia, Ethiopia and Libya. Well, Persia is very similar to Iran. Verse 6, Gomer and Togarma. Now the answer to this of the premillennialists and premillennial dispensations is it's not so much referring to nations, it's more referring to geographical entities. You know, so that Russia or the USSR, you know, different names and so forth, but pretty much the same thing. So that's the way they would try and get around that. It gets harder for them. What sort of transport is spoken of in the passage for the invading army?
Horses.
Verse 4 and verse 15 mention horses. So it's certainly, we're not talking here about a blitzkrieg. We're talking with horses. Now in World War I they were still on horses. But even in World War I they had tanks. They were bringing in tanks, early sort of developmental stage tanks, but they had tanks. But here, in the future, Israel is going to be attacked by horses. Now, if there's one country in the Middle East, as currently constituted, where you wouldn't stand much of a chance invading with horses, it is Israel. Let's go further. The transport of horses. What about the weapons? What weapons are used? Swords are mentioned.
Armor,
bucklers, shields. Bows and arrows are mentioned. Bows and arrows, and then God knocks them out of their hand in chapter 39, verse 3. 39, verse 9, as part of the fuel for the fire, mentions hand staves or javelins and spears. No rifles, no machine guns, no bombs, nothing like that. Against Israel. Think of the 6 days war and how Israel, rather impressively, mopped up all the surrounding nations. I mean, seriously, you guys are going for literalism? You take the nations literally, you take the transport literally, you take the weapons literally. Ah, but we don't really want to do that. No, but you said literalism. Then we have the issue of fuel, staying with chapter 39, verse 9, and now adding verse 10. The weapons that are going to be used, bows, arrows, javelins, spears, shields, large and small. There'll be no need for people, verse 10 says, to take wood out of the field. So you won't need to take saws or axes and cut down wood or tackle any forest, because you've enough wood for your fires to keep you going for 7 years. Now I'm curious, in this room, how many people have an open fire to burn wood? I know we don't, Mary. Sam, you have an open fire in your old house, out your new house?
A stove.
Okay, stove. That would count. Yes, stove. Hillary, do you guys? You have George. You have an open fire. You put wood in. Okay. Tibor, no. Julian and Mari, no. Okay. So let's say a bit more than half. I don't know if that's representative of the congregation or the Western world. Open fire is certainly cheery. I like an open fire. But anyway, open fires that weren't so popular with some of the environmentalists, but be that as it may, here it's presented as if people in verses 9 and 10 get the heating for their houses, practically everybody. What's the picture here? You go out, you cut down a tree, or you show off some branches. Really? Let's come to the next portion, the burying of the army. Chapter 39, verse 13 says the people of the land will do it. Verses 12 and 14 tells us 7 months. And verse 14 adds, they shall set apart men for regular employment to bury the people. By the way, when it talks about cleansing it too, cleansing the land, and the land being sort of unclean through the dead bodies, you know what that means? Old Testament ceremonial law. Is Old Testament ceremonial law obtaining before the tribulation? Surely Old Testament ceremonial law is really within their scheme only within the millennium. 7 months. Sorry, Mary?
Weapons?
Wooden weapons, yes. Bow and arrows, spears and javelins, and the shields. Then they have to be wood to burn, yeah. So 7 months to bury these people. What about a bulldozer? I mean, it may seem rather crude. I mean, the human bodies, you know, God has given a natural instinct to treat them with respect. But when you're dealing with that sort of volume, there comes a time where you have to say, look, this is a health risk, all these dead bodies. You know, they're rotting and they're stinking. There's going to be infectious diseases and so forth. And there's animals foraging among them. The best we can do in these circumstances, bulldoze. But then moving from the anachronism issue to coherence, just to pick up on one thing. We pointed out earlier that chapter 39, verse 4, talks about ravenous beasts and birds eating the dead bodies. And then chapter 39, verses 17 through 20, so four whole verses, speak about this in great detail. Son of man, speak To the birds and the beasts, come together. I've made a sacrifice. Eat flesh, drink blood, including the blood of the princes of the earth, and be satiated and filled at my table. How does this fit, though, with the burials? And the burials, if the birds and so on are going to eat and devour all this flesh, that surely would speed up the burial time. That you might need 7 months. If the animals actually came, ate the dead bodies and were left with a few bones, it'd be a whole lot, and just as a physical exercise, easier to bury the dead bodies. So I'm asking, is this coherent? It's not. It's not coherent. It's filled with anachronisms. And this is exactly the point, because this passage is pointing to something far greater. But I don't want to go too far. Next time, we're going to explain more fully the positive treatment of the passage. We've been emphasizing more what it doesn't mean than what it does mean. We're going to explain how this fits with the last days and within broader eschatology. If you are willing, you may well wish to follow up on homework. Now, I'm not your teacher, and there are no lost grades, but I think you would enjoy the class, benefit from it more, if you read Ezekiel 38 and 39 on your own before next time and try to wrestle with a passage. This class should help you, and you read over it, you'll get more out of it. In the next class, we're going to read Ezekiel 39. When you're on the reading theme, Revelation 20 would also help. And the parts of the Belgic Confession that we read right at the start of the class, paragraphs 1 and 3, you might want to read them again, because those are the two paragraphs within which, in Belgic Confession 37, within which it's helpful to fit the passages. You can sort of see how they tie in. But more, Lord willing, next time.